Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Bob Dumel, your host for The Buzz on Technical Rescue. Today's show, we're going to be looking into various aspects of rope rescue operations. My guest today is Mike Donahue. Mike is the owner and founder of Progressive Rescue and a 13-year veteran of the fire service. Spent the last 10 years with the City of Elizabeth, New Jersey Fire Department, where he's currently assigned to Rescue Company Number 1. He also has past experience in the volunteer community as well as federal firefighting. Mike's also part of the New Jersey Urban Search and Rescue Task Force, where he works as a rescue specialist. In the rest of Mike's free time, he's also an adjunct professor at Middlesex and Somerset Fire Academies and Middlesex Community College. You can take the opportunity to see Mike in the future, where he'll be presenting a hands-on component at Firehouse Expo 2010. It's going to be held between July 20th and 25th in Baltimore, Maryland, as well as contributing to Firehouse.com in the past. Mike, thanks for joining us today. How are you doing?
My pleasure. I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing very well. Talk a little bit about rope rescue today. Rope rescue is kind of like the core component of many of the special rescue activities that we take for granted kind of in the fire rescue community because it's such an inherent part of what we do. I look back kind of into my past, how things evolved over the last 10 or 20 years related to rope rescue. I know when I first came on, we were using manila hemp rope and would basically store it in any compartment that had space. If it was the one with the gas cans and the saws, so be it. Today's technology, we've come a long way from there. Just kind of start us out. In the area of safety, you know, what are some of the significant changes you've seen take place and some of your thoughts on that, Mike?
The biggest importance, I think, regarding safety is kind of, start from the ground up as far as, where you store your rope, where you store your equipment. You talked about back in the day, you used to throw it in a compartment with your chainsaws and gas cans, and that's totally unacceptable now because the vapors from the gas deteriorate the rope, and your best bet, what you need to do is everything needs to be bagged and tagged. So all your rope should be assigned a number, should be kept in a logbook. When you use it, it should be recorded. When you train on it, it should be recorded, even as far as estimating the percentage of wear on the rope, the weather you were training in it on, what you were doing. This way, it provides records for you that should everything ever happen, God forbid, you can go back and look, and there's a detailed list of who used it, when they used it, what they used it for. And even on the flip side, the equipment you're using, the hardware such as carabiners, pulleys, the software like your webbing, your anchor straps, your pickoff straps, that all needs to be kept in separate bags or boxes, however you decide to store it. Keep a solid inventory on it. Some departments, I know us in Elizabeth, will put little tags on it that if you crack the tag, you need to re-inventory the box and inspect the gear. Just a way of maybe maintaining quality control of it. We teach in Fire One, we teach the students basic rope rescue. If you drop that carabiner, some say more than 7 feet, I'll go with even 5 feet. It's out of service. It's downgraded the training because you can't see if there's hairline fractures in a beaner. You don't know. And it's until the time you're hanging off the side of a building or going to actually perform a rescue, you don't want to think about that stuff. You want to know your gear is 100% at a time.
That's a great point, that ability to authenticate the quality and the safety of the equipment we have. The reference of using a tag system or a type of seal on your containers, whether they're bags, hard containers, whatever, is something our department has transitioned into. It's also good for the volume of equipment you would have just for rope rescue. To do an inventory on a regular basis would be very time-consuming if you had to go through every single item one by one every time. So by having that container authenticated, it also adds much efficiency as we have so many hats we have to wear today in the fire service. This moves us forward in a very positive manner.
Absolutely.
Kind of
I mean, something else that you know people need to understand is, you know, I recently came across a department that you know, had a cache of rope rescue equipment, and there was tradespeople, you know, working on site that would come in and take their equipment to go perform, you know, confined space entries or use it for utility rope, and they wouldn't tell them. They would just come throw it back on the rig. And that's totally unacceptable because you don't know what happened to that equipment while it was out. You don't know if it was shock loaded, if equipment was dropped. You know, it's the same principle why you never use your life safety rope for utility rope or for training. You know, it's just one thing to have your training cache of life safety rope, but you need a cache of life safety equipment that's only used in the event of a rescue.
That's a very good point, you know, that control of our resources and our inventory is a major aspect of how we keep our people safe when they do reach into the compartment, take that piece of equipment out, and rely upon it for both their safety and the safety of the individuals we're being asked to go assist. And what's predominantly a very traumatic time in someone else's life, if we have to respond to a call, obviously something significantly wrong has gone, you know, taken place for that individual or group of individuals. We want to make sure we can bring them the safest operation as possible. As we evolve in the rope rescue aspect of things, knots, there's various knots out there, many different communities from the mariners and the shipfaring industry. Fishermen use a certain segment of knots. Right back to your youth, the Boy Scouts with certain knots. In the fire service, we've kind of evolved to a smaller cache of tools, in this case, the knots and hitches themselves. What are some of your thoughts on the ones we use on a more regular basis and maybe some pros and cons of what we've accepted into the fire service?
You know, anytime I teach knots, you know, the first thing that I tell the students is you got to learn how to tie these knots right 100% of the time. And the knots that the fire service adopted, you know, for our purpose of rescue, we did it for a reason. We did it for the strength of the knots. We did it through trial and error, through tests done on the knots, through research done on the strength the knots retain once they're tied, the percentage of strength loss in a rope once they're tied. You know, everybody knows that the half-inch static cremental rope we use, you know, you had that 9,000-pound rating on it. But as soon as you tie a knot in it, you're losing strength. If you tie a figure eight and a bite on it, you lose 21% strength rating on that rope. So you want to use knots that retain the highest strength rating. And you're absolutely right. There's tons of knots out there from the mariner world, the Boy Scouts, fishermen. And some of those knots we use in the fire service get confusing because some people still refer to them as a double fisherman's knot as opposed to a double barrel knot. So it is the same knot, just maybe serving a little bit different of a purpose. But when it comes down to it, you know, it's all about tying the knot correctly, you know, 100% of the time.
I'd have to agree with you there. It's the proficiency that we hope to build within our technicians, our rescuers, that they can do that knot very well. I think another very positive aspect of the evolution of rope rescue in the fire service is when we first got into this 20-plus years ago, you would have your little individual silos of skills where this individual could make this component work and that individual could make another component work, but we didn't have the knowledge and the foresight to know that, you know, everybody has to be equally as strong because it's not as easy as just plugging one individual into one place on a constant basis due to availability or many other factors that could come up. So I think the point you make about making sure you can do it right to 100% satisfaction every time is so important because these are aspects of rescue that happen very quickly and we don't have a lot of time offered to us to go back and redo things. So doing it right the first time definitely pushes that safety envelope to the most, you know, high level of possibilities for us.
You know, I really don't think we need, I don't think you need hundreds of knots in the fire service. You know, anytime you teach a rope class or a rigging class, you know, there's an acronym I came up with called C, simple, effective, and efficient. You know, and you've heard of KISS, keep it simple, stupid. You know, the less you have to confuse people, the better. You know, the fire service has that core group of knots that can really be applied in any situation. You know, you have knots that can face directions. You have knots that can be loaded three ways. You have knots that are just used for utility. You know, you want to keep it simple if the knots you're using are still effective. You know, and to touch on that 100% rule again, I don't mean to beat it to death, but I'll even go as far as when I teach these classes, I'll have the students blacked out and have them learn to tie these knots in the dark. Because you're not always performing an operation in the daylight on a nice sunny day. Sometimes you're in a dark, confined space. You're on a ship in the rain at night. So if you could perform it with your eyes closed 100% of the time, it's going to eliminate the stress of having to do it in a real-life situation where conditions are, you know, not really par.
Very true. If we train to the extreme situations, we'll be able to handle them when we, you know, are faced with them under an emergency situation. Plus, I think it's another very positive way of building someone's self-confidence and a skill set that could definitely fall into one of the seldom-used categories. These are skills that take, you know, quite a while to be proficient in as far as that motor mechanics of your hands manipulating the rope, in this case, in a manner that's successful for you. The other thing we've noticed, too, is terminology. You touched a little bit about it in reference to the double fisherman's net. As I travel around, depending on the region I'm in, and sometimes even with in certain localities, one department will call it one thing, one will have a different name for it, all of which are acceptable, but it just kind of identifies one of those common terminology situations we could run into as you travel around. We're all saying the same thing, but with different local vernacular for it. Have you run into that with any of your students coming from other areas as they move into your community?
You know, unfortunately, well, I should say fortunately, I haven't. For the most part, we'll take the double fisherman's knot again. People generally know either it's double fisherman or it's a barrel knot, because most of the books you read will refer to it both as a double fisherman or a barrel knot. You know, a figure eight to figure eight, there might be some confusion as far as figure eight follow-throughs or a figure eight bend being referred to as a tracer eight. You know, and little things like that, but I don't find it to be anything to the extreme that really hampers, you know, the learning process or even, you know, the rescue process on scene. I think overall, you know, the rope rescue community is probably on the same page as far as the foundations, you know, such as that.
Right. Okay. And, you know, once we get our knots down and, you know, we're moving through both with our students and into an operational situation, you know, we start looking at now, these are usually multifaceted type of activities. When we get there and start an operation, you know, the foundation of everything we do being a quality anchor to work from, and then we build into our belays and main lines with anchoring. Pros and cons of anyone that you've used in particular, or some that you may consider good bread and butter type of anchor systems to deploy your teams the quickest with?
You know, I think one of the best anchor systems going out there today, if you can get a single solid bomb-proof anchor, is going to be the tensionless hitch or the tensionless anchor, because you're wrapping your rope around that anchor object, you're clipping your knot back onto the line, and that knot is not seeing any load, so you're still retaining the strength in the rope, as opposed to, say, just a single point anchor system where you're wrapping an anchor strap or a piece of webbing around that bomb-proof anchor, clipping your knot into the beaner, you know, that knot's seeing a load now, so you're losing that 18% to 21%, whatever it is, you know, based on a knot you're using. The tensionless hitch, it's fast. It's really easy. I mean, there's things you need to know about it. Your rope should all line up on top of each other so that friction is distributed equally around the object. But it's really quick, it's really fast, and it's really efficient. But, you know, overall, the big picture, you know, students are taught your number one anchor is going to be a bomb-proof anchor, something that's structural, something that, you know, if the building collapses, it may still be there, something you can look at and know that that's structural. If you look at something and it's questionable, well, then it's a questionable anchor, and you have to back it up.
And I think that's a good point, going with a solid, substantial anchor, a bomb-proof anchor. Early on in the rope rescue evolution in the fire service, there was a large percentage of focus on multi-point and self-equalizing anchors. I think, unfortunately, we took a very good concept and maybe went off in the wrong direction at times, thinking that if we were using a self-equalizing anchor and we lost one or more of the various components within that, we still had a safe situation on our hand, where in essence, if one part fell, the other percentages were going to be much higher, that the continuing components would fail themselves. So going to a single-point bomb-proof anchor, I think, is opening up the eyes of safety to a much higher degree than what we may have been doing early on in our development. Do you utilize any multi-point anchors? And if so, is there any, like, maybe specialized applications that they are still a benefit for us?
I would use a load-sharing anchor system, where you're grabbing two points or two anchors so that they're sharing the load. This self-equalizing anchor system is great, and I think it really becomes valuable out in the world of, like, wilderness rope rescue, where you're going down ravines or going down hills, where you're constantly changing your angle. So that weight is being shot at that angle point at different angles. Whereas when we're performing rescues off the side of buildings, off bridges, for the most part in fire service, we're trying to keep all our lines straight. So the self-equalizing, I don't think, is used as often in fire service as it is in the world of, wilderness rope rescue. I would say definitely the load-sharing anchor is used all the time. Tensionless hitch or tensionless wrap is used all the time. And just to back up for a second regarding the bomb-proof anchors or questionable anchors, one important point I like to throw out about the questionable anchors is if you're backing that anchor up, it has to be backed up by an anchor of equal or greater strength or size. It wouldn't make any sense to back up an anchor with something weaker. The whole point of that backup anchor is to catch a load in the event that it falls. And a lot of people may not realize that or really think about it, but you really just need to search out and find that good solid backup anchor.
And I think that's a key point, that backup anchors, things of that nature, and in the area of different style of anchors are changes of directions, sometimes are components of the overall operation that are added into the sequence as it's evolving. It's one of those things where they can allow their thought process to catch up with their activities so that they don't push forward at a pace where they're picking less than desirable anchors to accomplish the task. So as we do everything, that continuous focus on safety has to be a key component of what we're doing.
I mean, that's the foundation of any rope rescue operation, is going to be your anchor. So you as a rescuer need to kind of take a step back, take a deep breath, let your adrenaline go down a little bit, and really survey the scene and look at what you're working with. Because you don't want to choose that anchor you see right off the bat. Even though it seems great, it's a bomb-proof anchor, it's going to suit your needs. If it's at a lousy angle, it may be fine initially when you set it up, but it may become a hazard or a problem later on in the operation when you actually have people on rope. So to really survey the scene and look at what you have is very important. And just to touch again the last time with bomb-proof anchors, something I do, and I'm really safety redundant, is even if I have a bomb-proof anchor, I'll then take another anchor strap, wrap that anchor, and I'll put what's called a directional 8 in the actual anchor line and clip a secondary anchor. So I'm actually backing up my bomb-proof anchor. I'm not so much worried about the bomb-proof anchor failing. I'm more concerned about should a carabiner fail, should that connection point fail. I know that it's backed up and it's safe.
Redundancy is definitely a key element in providing that overall safety of the operation. Once we've got our systems, our anchors in place to move forward, first thing we need to remember is, making sure if there is a failure, we have a mechanism to protect our rescuers. Basically, the belay system in rope rescue is what we depend upon as our fail-safe. What are some of the belay systems you utilize, and pros and cons of those?
Well, the two main belay systems that I use, one of the most common belay systems that I use is the tandem Prusik wrap, which is two pieces of Prusik cord triple wrapped around the rope. That's going to keep you in line with your safety ratio as per the NFPA. And the great thing about the tandem Prusik wraps, all of that, if they're going to fail, you know they're going to fail. They're going to skip down the rope. And I've seen Prusik actually fuse to the rope before they fail. So it's giving you warning. It's telling you, hey, something's wrong with the system. The system's being overloaded. We need to take care of this now. As opposed to maybe a piece of hardware that you're using for a belay, which may just fail without any kind of warning. A second belay that I use that's out there that, you know, I think is fantastic is something called a 540 rescue belay. And it, for you to look at it, it looks like a big pulley, almost like a kootenai or a not-passing pulley. But there's a cam inside that. Should that rescuer drop, should it be a sudden shock load applied to it, it's going to lock up almost immediately. I think maybe 2 centimeters of rope will slide through before it locks up. And there's a lever on the back that will release that load. So you throw that lever in the direction that the load is going, and it will reset it. If you're using those tandem Prusiks, it's not that easy. You have to have a mechanical advantage system built on the top side or away from wherever your rescue is going over, then pull that belay line up to offload those Prusiks. So there's pros and cons with everything. I lean more towards now using that 540 a lot out in the field.
And that's another great example of how the industry has evolved for us, especially in the area of safety. Like any benefit in any aspect of the fire service comes the economic factor, a 540 device being significantly more of a financial investment, but for a department or a group of departments that are working together to create a rope rescue team, it definitely is the direction to go, building these devices into your daily operations. Another thing we use in our area for single-person load would be a Munter hitch, which we found very effective, and single loads only. And when we get into our various other specialties, such as confined space, it's a very advantageous tool. Minimal effort on the operator's part, plus in confined space, we're looking at traditionally only moving a single person load at a time because of the configurations we're forced to work under, as far as sites and openings, things of that nature. So the nice thing is there's a wide variety of options out there for us, and the more we evolve into it, the different levels of proficiency we aspire to, it gives us an opportunity to start building capabilities from many different angles.
Absolutely. And it's good to be, it's good to have a good working knowledge of all the belay systems out there, because even if you constantly use the 540, to know how to tie the triple wrap Prusik is a great skill, because, you know, you use that time and time again in a lot of different applications in the rope rescue.
Very true. So as we, you know, we've got our belay up, we've got some anchors in place. Mechanical advantage systems, once again, come in many different configurations. We have our site constructed out of various components that we have within our cache. Also, the manufactured systems that are pre-built and designed to come in basically one working package that answers quite a few different challenges. How about your thoughts on, you know, what are some of the mechanical advantages you find yourselves using on a high percentage of your operations?
I think the most common mechanical advantage system we're going to use out there is really between a 4-to-1 and a 5-to-1. And that's really the max you're going to be able to use, just based on the fact that if you're pulling, we'll take a confined space as an example. If you're pulling somebody out of a confined space, and we'll just throw, say you're using an 8-to-1, and that victim's arm gets hooked on something, you know, you're not going to be able to feel it. Just because of the weight that's taken up by that mechanical advantage system, you're going to feel like you're pulling very little weight. So you could very likely dislocate that victim's arm or shoulder by using a mechanical advantage system that's too large. So, you know, by the standards, 5-to-1 is really the max you're going to want to use. And it's really convenient because you could build that 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 a couple different ways. We use it a lot in the form of a block and tackle. It's just very convenient. You'll see a lot of those block and tackles pre-made. There's one, a rescue mate that's pre-made, which I think are fantastic. But the biggest problem I've seen with that is if that rescue mate gets pulled out of the bag and it's been tangled, it was packed improperly, it's not going to work right. If guys don't know the foundation, don't know how to build a 4-to-1 or 5-to-1, they're not going to be able to fix it. So you need to had that solid foundation of the mechanical advantage systems to understand so that, yeah, if you want to use that pre-made system, terrific. But if it comes out and it's not ready to go, you need to be able to fix it.
I think that's an excellent point to hit on is, you know, pre-rigging is definitely the efficiency model to follow, and most of what we do in the fire service, specifically in rope rescue, a very positive component. One of the best tricks of the trade that I learned through a student in a class, what their department has done to help identify and deal with that situation where you would build your 4-to-1, 5-to-1 combination block and tackle style system, you would put it into the carry bag with the rope, and through traveling that, it would vibrate and the carabiners, or excuse me, the pulleys would flip over, creating that functionless situation you were referring to. What they've done is when they pack it, they can track the system as tight as possible and then wrap it in 2 or 3 wraps of a very light gauge saran wrap type of material so it holds everything in place. They've also evolved to where in their mariner's hitches or their BC, British Columbia load release hitches, doing the same configuration so that the mechanisms were held as they were designed to for travel, and it was very easily removed when it was put into operation. So a good example of, you know, necessity stepping up and, you know, taking care of these things from within, but the fact that they were out sharing this information was so valuable to the others who sat through this program, they were able to go home and take some new skills with them.
Absolutely. There's a lot of tricks to trade like that, and any way you can find to control that system in the bag is only going to help you out. So I like that saran wrap. Might use that.
It's you know, and once again, the best thing about the fire service, there are so many people out there with very, you know, process-orientated thoughts that are always evolving these for us. And the great thing is most everybody's always looking to share it with someone else, passing it on, paying it forward, per se, so that the next person doesn't run into the same problems that they had as they were going through their development curve. And, you know, with rope rescue, we're constantly learning. When you think you get to the point where you know everything, you now become probably more of a problem than an asset, because there is no point where the educational process ceases. We're always finding ways to improve upon both our individual and our group level skills. We get into the challenges faced in rope rescue. I know personally, working in a primarily urban environment, edge transition can be one of our biggest challenges, how to get a victim once we've effected contact with them, packaged them, and are now bringing them especially into an upward position and over an edge, how to do that in a manner where we're really not creating a secondary trauma for them, first being the situation to put them in a place where they needed our assistance. But for edge transition, are there any activities or tricks that you folks use that you found to be very beneficial?
You know, there's a bunch of different tips or tricks that you kind of figure out along the way just through training and trial and error. Something that I found really works great is initially, you know, you're absolutely right about you don't want to further any trauma a victim may have. Patient care is obviously the first and foremost job that we're going to perform out there. We're there to perform a rescue, and we want to bring that patient down without any kind of further harm. So getting that victim over the edge really becomes a team effort. Utilizing pieces of webbing or pieces of rope or accessory cord tied to stokes or tied to the sked will really ease the transition up and over the edge, whether you're going over the edge of a 5-story walk-up or you're going over the edge of a multi-story high-rise. You could use the same principle using rescuers, grabbing the sides of the stokes, the sides of the sked. I found that using webbing or rope works a lot better because they can keep tension on that stokes or the sked 5, 6, 7, 8 feet down. And really the trick to it or the secret to it is keeping constant pressure in the main line, in those control lines, for the entire duration of going from the top side over the edge. If you all work as a team, you all keep the same pressure, you should get over the edge with ease.
It's a good point, the teamwork aspect. This is definitely one of the areas of specialized rescue that one or two individuals physically cannot pull off the job. We require multiple sets of hands. Each different aspect requires that person. personal attention to safety and function. So by utilizing your group together, you hit the nail right on the head, I think. It's a major teamwork type of activity. Once we've accessed the victim, brought them up, many of our operations, too, are done in places where scene control can become a problem. I've seen operations where good intentions, good Samaritans, or trained rescuers have put them in position themselves. I'm going to start over. I've seen situations where good intention or trained rescuers have put themselves in situations where they are now part of the problem. So scene management is definitely one of the most important parts for both the safety of the victim, but as well the safety of the rescuers. Are there any activities that you utilize in your area that will help others, maybe advance their ability to control a scene of this nature?
Well, in any rescue operation, scene control is first and foremost. And it really comes down to, I think, the incident commander delegating that command out to the different operations or stations that are going to be going on. I think it's easier to have a successful operation with a good communication foundation laid down. If you have rigging going on, have an officer assigned to rigging. If you have patient packing or patient care going on, they have an officer assigned to that. So if there's any questions or information that needs to be relayed, it's only going through 3, 4, or 5 different people as opposed to 10 different rescuers yelling 10 different things. Police should be maintaining crowd control. The less people that are around, less people that want to help, it's a person's natural instinct to want to help. And it's great that civilians have that attitude, but sometimes that good-natured, I want to help you out, can actually cause a little bit of a problem. So to maintain that solid, good scene control, have the good leadership, have good officers running those stations, if you can keep that good, keep that flow moving, it's really going to help out your operation.
Yeah, I agree. And your comment on communications being so important. And one of the things we try to impart on our students and our more seasoned members is when you communicate, we use the repeat method or the echo system, as we refer to it. Basically, if I give a command or a request, I want that person to repeat the exact request I gave out back so that A, I know they heard me, and B, I know that they heard exactly what I said. There's a lot of background noise, a lot of commotion. So by echoing those commands back and forth, what we're doing is actually authenticating that it was heard and it was heard properly so that we can help avoid negative situations from taking place.
Right. It eliminates any confusion. And even down to basic radio communications. If there's 10 guys in a certain area, everybody has a radio on, and your officer keys up, if you have feedback, people need to know to cover their lapel mics, turn their radios down, so that his message is heard clearly. The worst thing to do is give your commands or give your reports through a radio that has nothing but feedback going through it. It could be some vital information that's lost in that transmission because of that.
And that's an excellent point. I think these are the things, when you look at them in the big picture, they're very small components, but it's always the little pieces that gear us towards a successful outcome. So by working that way, and the communications as well amongst each other, it becomes much more efficient.
Well, if you get enough of those small components that aren't working that or aren't being attended to, those small components can become a big component.
Very true, and that goes definitely right back to the heart and soul of command and control, having the right people in the right positions to affect a safe operation. One of the other things, too, we always have to keep in mind is a lot of times the victim is brought up, taken into advanced care through our EMS providers or whoever happens to be on scene, but the operation isn't over until we have all of our people up in a safe haven, our equipment removed from the danger zone. We're still really in that full go mode. So sometimes these are the other part of that command and control aspect of an incident where you need to take care of your own and make sure that we don't leave an individual suspended over a gorge, over the edge of a building, or in any hazardous situation longer than we need to.
That's a fantastic point, because once the operation is over, you kind of take a step back, and you may drop your guard a little bit, but there's still a lot on the line, breaking the gear down, you know, getting off of wherever you are. It's like working in a trench. When that trench operation's over, it's just as dangerous removing the shoring you put in the trench as it was putting it in. So a good rescuer is going to be on his toes 100% of the time.
Definitely a good point. As we start to wrap up today, a couple of things we can kind of look at from our conversation is that rope rescue is a very involved type of activity, one of the areas that you could go on for an extended period of time because of all the different components and break them down piece by piece and actually do a very in-depth session on those. So maybe something in the future we could talk on. I want to thank Mike for joining me today. We hope everyone enjoyed the session. You can also look forward to seeing Mike at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland, July 20th and 21st. He'll be presenting Rope Rescue Made Simple in one of the hands-on components there. Sessions are being held from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day. Sign up early as class sizes are limited to 35 participants per session. This is a great opportunity to go enjoy the expo, talk, network, meet other firefighters from around the nation, and get some good hands-on experience as well as enjoying the classroom component and the exhibition hall. This is your host, Bob Dummel. I want to thank you for listening and have a very safe day.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.